and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new or returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And I think there's been a bit of a hiatus, but I've been posting episodes as I can during the summer. It's been a wild summer, and this latest interview is happening after a pretty tragic week, but I am optimistic and hopeful for things to come, and I'm really excited, as I always am, for the latest guest, Nashawn Anderson, who is an emerging writer, currently a Lambda Lit Fellow, previously a Vona Fellow, and also a NYSCA Grants Review Panelist. So thank you so much, Nashawn, for being on the podcast this weekend.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's so interesting how we connected, because I actually had heard about your writing from the Bronx Council Arts and stuff like that, and also Vona, which is a conference for artists of color, and that becomes a very close-knit community as well. And you correct. Being a part of that, and Lambda Literary, and being the first Bryn Kelly Fellow as well. So it's really great to always have emerging artists, and also we're going to be talking about grants, which is something we have not talked about on this podcast, and I think it's extremely important and overlooked. So I really, really, really appreciate you being open to that conversation. But your background is not just in writing, it's also in entertainment. And I know writing is a form of entertainment. So your professional background is in film and television, an industry that, like publishing, has been called out for not being representative enough. They were inclusive to other aspects of intersectionality? Or did it seem that even being POC, there's still a disparity in terms of understanding intersectionality and the struggles others face who are of different backgrounds?
I can only speak for the companies where I've been employed at. And during 1997, while working on the Keenan Ivory Wayne show, I discovered several of my coworkers were members of the LGBT community, and it was a non-issue. While I briefly worked at Buena Vista Television, whose parent company is Walt Disney Studios, there were two African-American executives, a male and a female, as well as a female executive in charge of production that was lesbian. I would give Walt Disney Studios an A regarding diversity issues. During 1998, when I was employed on Russell Simmons' One World Music Beat, at Tri-Crown Productions, the executive producer was a Latin effeminate homosexual. No one ever questioned that or me. Regarding working with disabled individuals, I don't recall ever having a coworker who was obviously disabled. No one had ever disclosed that information to me. I myself am legally disabled and have been since 2005. However, I believe when individuals look at me, that would be the last thing that would come to their mind, that I'm a disabled individual. I have what you would consider an invisible disability. Yes. Regarding religion, that's a touchy subject, which is usually not brought up, and people pretty much respect that. And I don't want to say, because it's the entertainment industry, people are not religious, but I really don't remember it being saying, oh, you know, I'm Catholic, I'm Buddhist, I'm Protestant, I'm Jehovah's Witness. I mean, it's the entertainment industry, so most people pretty much enjoy what they do. That just has not been a real, that hasn't been, it hasn't come up in too many conversations as with me. And I would have to say, even though I had worked on various productions, TV and film projects, and there were plenty of people of color there, and the LGBT people have always been there and are always going to be there. I would the disparity still does exist. It does still exist. For me to have worked in the industry for almost over two decades, I've always heard this conversation, and this is the first time that I have ever participated in a conversation like this. I didn't think as I aged that I would be participating in this conversation as well regarding issues of diversity and inclusion. But unfortunately, it seems like it is a never-ending story. So here we are still discussing it.
Sadly. And I worry that when it comes to the industry, especially publishing industry, that people think just because a person who was marginalized wrote something about another marginalization, so me being hetero but black and then writing about the LGBT community means that I should know better, quote unquote, but that doesn't absolve me of the same issues.
Hold on, I'm sorry. When you say, in that sense, when you say should know better...
This is a conversation I've had with others in the industry, is that people feel like when you're marginalized, you should know better, in that you should be as respectful as possible in terms of that depiction that is not yours, because what's been discussed is that, oh, well, white people do this, white people do that, and they don't think about how it affects POC. But if I'm POC, am I also, and POC identifying as hetero, does that mean, even though I may have been upset by some white depictions of blackness, that I'm going to be as cautious as a hetero person for the LGBTQ community, or as an able person for the disabled community? And so that's where the should comes in. It's like, oh, well, you know what it's like to be misrepresented and marginalized, mm-hmm. so you should make sure to do this for other aspects of marginalization. But
which
it doesn't always happen, obviously.
No, people don't operate like enough. So I'm sorry. I mean, the reality of it is that's the farthest thing from the truth. It would be nice if people felt as if they should operate that way, but mm-hmm. they don't.
Absolutely.
They don't know.
That was like an even.
And they don't feel. And they don't feel. They don't feel like that's their duty, or their. That's. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like that's their responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. Yeah. No. I think that was even more succinct. It's like, no.
pretty cut and dry.
Like, I've experienced some goodness, but no. Yeah. You've been honored by the Bronx Council of the Arts, Vona Fellow, as mentioned, and now the Bryn Kelly Scholarship via Lambda Literary. So while the Bronx Council Award isn't targeted as marginalized specific, these kinds of organizations, and maybe because there's such a large POC demographic in the Bronx too, that these kinds of organizations and spaces they provide are aimed at marginalized artists. In that regard, do you think you'd continue to write if it weren't for these spaces or for the grants that you've been able to attain? And what do you think spaces that aren't specific to this demographic can or should do to be more inclusive?
I began writing with no knowledge of the tremendous support that was available for writers to access. I eventually discovered very support on my own by participating in grant writing workshop and reading various artist biographies. Receiving local and state art council grants, grants from private foundations, writing fellowships, and scholarship, all of that is a bonus and reaffirms to me that what I'm doing is crucial, valued, and appreciated. The support specifically from Lambda Literary Foundation, Voices of Our Nation Arts Foundation, and the National Arts and Disabilities Center has made me feel as if I have a permanent cheerleading squad on my team and that I'm on my way to possibly winning a Pulitzer. No, I'm just kidding. However, I do believe anything is possible to achieve if you're talented enough. The encouragement is everything, and it really boosts your confidence along the way. So yes, I would continue to write even if there were not spaces for marginalized writers, because I enjoy storytelling and would find someone to entertain that appreciates my narratives. Regarding the question earlier, what do I think spaces that aren't specific to the demographic can and should do to be more inclusive? I feel like they should seek to diversify their memberships and services they offer instead of catering to the same demographic. They should be more welcome and be more welcoming. People will go where they feel welcomed and connected. However, at the same time, I feel marginalized people must go out of their comfort zone as well to connect with different institutions and organizations, different cultural organizations, mm-hmm. rather than just staying put in their communities. It's a two-way street. And in order to open up the lines of communication, marginalized groups, people of color, disabled individuals, LGBT, we have a role to play in that as well. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't just be sitting around waiting for them to come to us. We can go to them as well.
We were talking before I recorded about being resourceful and finding those resources. And for me, one of my biggest ones was my aunt. She subscribed to me for Writer's Digest, I believe, and Poets and Writers. And they have a lot of things listed in there.
They do. They have a ton of information.
Ton. Mm-hmm. And now we have the internet. So to me, now that we have the internet, this grand, huge scale I mean, Google is a verb now.
It kind of levels out the playing field to a degree.
Yeah, to a degree. It definitely is. If you don't know the
information,
keywords.
The information is there. The information is there. Google is my best friend.
Yeah, Google, it's a noun and a verb.
Google is my best friend.
But being resourceful, finding these things, and I do wonder about how do people get to know about it? Because we talk about networking and not everyone's into the networking, the idea of networking. I'm using mm-hmm. quotation marks when I say the word networking because I feel as though
sometimes that can
means
just,
different things to different people. It's an exertion of energy.
It can be a waste of time. At times, it can be a complete waste of time, and then you can get possibly frustrated because you used your time.
Mm-hmm. No, of course, and that could be writing time or napping
yes,
time or
correct.
Researching. Getting updated mm-hmm. on something, mm-hmm. binge watching. But how do we get people to? I mean, it's not. We're not going to solve all the answers to the earth in this episode or any episode technically, but I feel as though there's still this kind of fall off point where people are still being blocked, and maybe blocked is too strong a word, maybe it's not, from getting to know this information. Because as we were talking about, sometimes people just aren't forthright. You know, people are worried about, why do you want this information? What does it mean to me?
Oh,
as
yes,
artists,
yes,
we're always
yes.
going to be quote-unquote competing. And then right. some people say, don't look at being an artist as a competition. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you kind of use, oh, well, if you get it, then I don't get it. And I feel like that's the kind of a jumping off point where people are concerned
well,
about diversity. Because they're like, oh, well, if more POCs get it, then are you rewarding POCs just for being, you know, is this the affirmative action of publishing?
And you can't, you know, I've contacted organizations and places seeking legitimate information, and I haven't always gotten a response. And I just, you know, I just chalk it up to it is what it is. And, you know, sometimes I'll say, okay, you know, let me use email address number two, mm-hmm. email address number three. I have quite a few.
Yeah.
But when I don't get a response, I just move on. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm expecting one and I know that I should receive one.
Yes.
I don't spend too much time trying to figure out why I did not mm-hmm. get the information that I was seeking. The information is pretty much out there. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of research. I've had to do a lot of research in order for me to exist in New York, this place. Mm-hmm. Concrete jungle. this has been one of the hardest things that I've done in my life, trying to establish myself as a writer. Coming from California with my background in acting, TV and film production, it's one of those things that I couldn't even begin to imagine that the experience was going to be what it was. The Lower Manhattan Council, LMCC, for me, what I found benefited me was once I discovered the various art councils, local art councils, mm-hmm. Brooklyn, Queens, Bronx, Staten Island, they have a wealth of information on their websites. Mm-hmm. And the Lower Manhattan Council on the Arts last year, because I know they're not offering it this year, if I'm correct, they're not offering it this year because I had checked on it. I had attended Fundraising Fundamentals,
oh.
where it's a month-long it's considered a workshop for artists to find out about grants and mm-hmm. scholarships and aid for artists to help you assist you with your careers. Mm-hmm. And we met once a week for, I think it was 2 to 3 hours. And at the end of it, if you had attended all the events, you were then given the option to meet with, I believe it was a grant writer, or it was someone from the Lower Manhattan Council on the Arts to go over application with you for something that you were applying for. It just so happened that upon reading the information, I discovered a grant that I was eligible for, and I applied for it. And within a month, I had a check in the mail. Had I not attended the Lower Manhattan Council on Arts Fundraising Fundamentals, I wouldn't have gotten that packet, but also wouldn't have gotten that grant. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person, I'm always looking out, I'm always paying attention, I'm very observant, mm-hmm. And I know to apply myself, because more than likely, if I apply, I may, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. be chosen for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And I was looking into that more, and sometimes it's I always say the cost-benefit analysis, of is this worth your time based on what you get out of it. And I think in terms of the more residencies you apply for, the more conferences you apply for, the more grants you apply for, you get better at, hopefully, you get better at applying. You get better at being able to find the wording to say, this is my project and this is why I deserve X, Y, and Z. So maybe the cost benefit in that regard, if you don't get it.
You get better at selling your project.
Exactly.
Your product, yes.
Yeah.
So it's not a waste of time, and it's a part of the work, especially if you want the time and the energy to do the work. You have to make the time to apply for these different programs.
And it seems also that the smaller ones, people shouldn't discount the small ones, because those can add up, because everyone's going for the big ones. Everyone's going for the NEA. Because that's nationwide. That's not even statewide. That's nationwide, the NEA. Right. So you have even more competition, if you don't mind me using the C word.
And then, oh, no. That's one of my favorite words. Competition. Bring it on. Yes. Life ain't a party if it ain't no competition.
And then the NYFA, which is all of New York City. And that's, you know, all five. Instead of competing with the Queens, that probably came out right. But like,
you're competing with the Queens and the Kings and the Brooklynites and the Bronxites. And
yeah, well, Brooklyn is technically Kings County.
Brooklyn is
Kings. There you go, Kings and the Queens.
Right, yeah. Yes.
The Manhattanites, you're competing against everybody. So it does seem, and every state has these arts grants. Every single state has arts grants.
It wasn't until I relocated here from California, which I go back and forth to California. It wasn't until I relocated here that I even realized that there was a
New York
State Council on the Arts, that there was a California Arts Council, that there were, I'm from Pasadena, California, that there was even a Pasadena Arts. I had no knowledge of local art councils.
Because they don't advertise themselves.
No, that's the whole thing.
It's not as though that's what you're seeing ads in. You're seeing ads for MFAs and workshops and stuff like that. You're not seeing people say, hey, we have
it's not advertised, and it's government funding for arts and culture. Every year the governors set aside a budget, and they get federally funded dollars, and different states get certain amounts and different cities get certain amounts, and it's for artists to enrich the communities that they live in. To add to our culture.
But you know what? I should actually take back, it's not advertised. I feel as though it's back to what we were saying, which is certain people know about it.
Well, I don't know if advertise is the correct word. Again, if you go to the New York City, if you go to the 3311 or New York City's website, you'll be directed to the DC Department of Cultural Affairs website. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get taken to NISCA's website. NYFA, that's different. All of the art councils are connected to the state. So and there are a lot of websites out there that have all of the information on there. Yeah. It's really more so either you have to know someone in city government or you have to be an artist. It's not generally known to the public.
Absolutely.
So I guess that's why we would say that it's not advertised, because the general public does not necessarily know about it. It's something that really is amongst the artist communities. Yeah.
And I saw some in, but that's also the thing, because with poets and writers, I saw some of them. You know, I would see the NEA, because that's huge. And, you know, it's the NEA, Grant, National Endowment of the Arts. But I'm not necessarily seeing New York, Illinois, you know, Connecticut, and so forth. I learned more about NYFA because someone told me about NYFA. Someone said, oh, you know, there's New York Foundation for the Arts. I said, oh, really? How much does that cost? Oh, it's free, da-da-da-da-da, and this is how you apply. And then someone else is like, oh, well, you know, Bronx has one. And I said, what? So maybe Queens has one if Bronx has one. So then I checked, and I said, wow, Queens has. So then it's that kind of tiered information where you're getting tidbits. So you're wondering maybe, oh, well, I wonder if, and then you use Google.
You're getting tidbits and you're getting hints and tips, and one thing leads to another. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, you'll be applying for 20 workshops and grants and scholarships, and you'll be waiting and waiting and biting your fingernails off and poking your eyeballs out, hoping that you know, get those checks or those acceptance letters. it can give you, once you find out the information and you start applying, it can give you so much to look forward to. Mm-hmm. It really, really can. Mm-hmm. And it is career changing. It is.
Yeah. It is good on the resume because...
Yes, it is.
I believe you were saying you don't necessarily have a lot of publications. But no, you have won several grants and fellowships.
I have. The only thing that I have been published in so far is the Bronx Memoir Project, which was the Bronx Writing Center received a $40,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, mm-hmm. and it was the first of its kind in the nation. Mm-hmm. And I just so happened to be living in the Bronx at that time, and I decided to submit a 1,000-word narrative to be a part of it, and it was selected. So, yeah, I'm still trying to get someone to pay attention to me and listen to me. So.
I noticed you.
you did notice me, yes, you did. You noticed me, and the people at Vona did, and the people at Lambda did. And regarding Lambda, mm-hmm. this is extra special for me, this trip. Had there not been a writer by the name of Bryn Kelly, my participation as a Lambda Fellow this year would not have been, I don't even know how to say it.
Wouldn't have come to fruition, per se?
It wouldn't have been this easy. Mm-hmm. Bryn was a writer. She was a transgender female from Brooklyn, and she passed away in January. Mm-hmm. And when I applied for Lambda, I was just applying for Lambda as just a writer, mm-hmm. and I did apply for financial aid. I'm low income, not a starving artist, but I'm not wealthy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And after I was notified that I was a fellow, within two months, a month went by, and I was told that I was the recipient of the Bryn Kelly Scholarship, and I was kind of confused. I mean, I knew who she was, and I knew mm-hmm. her name. Mm-hmm. But I didn't understand
what that had
to do with me, a scholarship, because I didn't apply. I didn't apply for it.
Oh, okay. And then, I didn't realize that.
And then I was told that after she had passed, they had taken up. There was a fundraiser mm-hmm. for a transgender individual to be given a scholarship mm-hmm. in honor of her, and I was chosen by her partner to receive the first scholarship. Wow. So that meant a lot. Mm-hmm. To me, to be chosen, and in remembrance of her.
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something good comes out of something bad.
I mean, you know, I applied for something and ended up getting, I guess one could say more than what I bargained for, and mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, mm-hmm. It's, and I was going to apply for Lambda, the previous year. But I got so busy with applying for so many other things that I didn't get a chance to do it. And I made sure I got my packet in and everything, you know, taken care of and on time and everything. And when I was told that I was accepted, it was there's so much joy there. There's so much happiness there to be able to participate in something directly with the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. Total satisfaction and happy. Mm-hmm. Just very excited, very looking forward to that.
Yeah,
I'm having my own residency on Amtrak for 4 days. I'm taking Amtrak out there to Los Angeles, and so because I didn't want to fly, so I'll be able to write and do some other things, and I'm really looking forward to that. I'm going from New York to California on the train, so
that is a nice. You packed two for one.
Yeah, that is going to be really, really cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show how much this funding is important, because it feels like a hustle. Writing can feel very much like, or really the permission to keep writing, or maybe permission is not the right word. But it feels kind of like unique, because we're not getting paid to write, so to speak.
No,
you know what I mean?
No.
We're not at that point yet. And mm-hmm. even when you do get to a point where you're getting an advance, it might not be a livable wage. It more than likely will not be a livable wage.
Well, then you still have to split it with your agent and some people.
Yeah. And you get it in pieces. You know, you don't get, you know, a $300,000 advance for those very few who get them is not $300,000 written to you after you sign the contract. That is not how it goes. You get it in pieces.
But for like NYFA, which is a nice, generous $7,000 grant, mm-hmm. which they call the gift of time. That is a very generous grant. And I know for me, when I was a recipient of the Bronx Council on the Arts Brio grant, $3,000, that was just...
Anytime
you are given something financially that's going to benefit you and that's going to assist you in doing what you're in pursuing your dream, so you can work on your craft and accomplish your goals, it's nothing but a bonus. It could be $500, it could be $100 that somebody actually thought that you deserved it.
Yes.
I mean, and for me, I'm an emerging writer, and for me to be on this journey and for me to have received a significant amount of grants and fellowships and scholarships, I'm a little bit overwhelmed because I'm like, okay, you know, what's next? A Nobel Peace Prize, a Pulitzer? I mean, no, no, it really does let me know, yeah. Nashawn, you are doing something right, mm-hmm. and you need to keep on doing it because mm-hmm. it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I went through to get to this point, mm-hmm. even with being alive, I know that I'm on the right path. Mm-hmm. It is mm-hmm. it is crystal clear to me. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. It's that crystal clear to me. And so I'm not, it's not surprising. At this point, it's not surprising to me anymore.
Good.
It's not.
Well, mm-hmm. you worked hard for it, Debbie, you know?
And I did not know that it was going to be this amount of work.
Oh my gosh, grants and statements.
Yeah, so that really outside of your writing, it really becomes a job in itself. And then you have to have someone edit that as well, and everything needs to be correct and factual, and you know, you have to show proof of certain things and everything. So it becomes very, very time consuming. Mm-hmm. And to a degree it can be a little bit nerve wracking after a while. It becomes very draining too.
Mm. I think that's probably another reason why people don't do them. It's because of the exertion of energy.
Yeah, it's a total roller coaster ride, but I've been on so many of them and my life has been like one, so I, mm-hmm. one more ride ain't gonna hurt, I guess. You know,
maybe a good one.
You know,
Well, I always tell people when I started applying for residencies, it's like applying for college. You know, when you get out of this point where you maybe get out of college and you think, I never have to apply for anything again. Okay. And it's total BS because right, you have to apply for jobs. And then you have to have the tight resume and the tight cover letter and then the references. And the same thing with residencies. You have to have the artist statement, the residency,
you do.
The portfolio. Well,
it's no difference. It's no difference with major superstars like Beyonce, Madonna, Halle Berry. Just because we know who they are and they've been in all these feature films that have grown hundreds of million dollars, if not almost billions of dollars, they still have to audition. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, yes, we know who you are, but you still have to audition for the role. So
yeah.
That's part of the business.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Never ending, folks.
And so if you want it, you're going to do it.
That's true. That's, I think that'll be the tagline for this episode. If you want
and
it.
I don't mind doing it.
The less y'all apply for, the more Nashawn gets.
You know, I came this far, and I've been through. I don't want to say hell and back, but I think what happens is you do like I'm saying a roll. You actually then get on a roll, not necessarily because you're receiving the funding and all that stuff, but you get on a roll. It becomes the more you do it, it becomes much more easier,
mm-hmm.
and you're actually able to deal with the rejection. As well, and you just say, okay, I'll just apply next year. I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
On one side of the coin, I've heard there's a lack of trust in terms of the sincerity of those wanting inclusion, and also that there's also been pushback for what's been done. So for you as a writer, artist, performer too, what do you think the sticking point is in terms of why we're at a stalemate when it comes to actually having more representative voices in the industry? And I'm speaking of the publishing industry.
Right. First and foremost, this is a business. And as much as folks would love to say that, you know, it's all about the art or creativity, that's false. All creative individuals are searching for an audience and are selling something or have an agenda. And if that wasn't the case, our art wouldn't have a price tag and we wouldn't be so competitive. The marketplace is already overly saturated with tons of voices and artists All artists are competing for exposure and audience and prestige, which can translate into financial success, which most desire. I personally feel established artists don't want to risk losing their platform or audiences, so it serves no purpose to allow too many voices to be exposed to the public. Even though companies' profits can increase, it still diverts resources and attention away from those who are used to being the dominant voice. That's why they seek to diminish other voices, and if they have the opportunity, will sabotage at all costs. It's not personal, it's just business and greed. It's like the little kid, you know, the kid at school, you know, who gets all the awards all the time, or their parents do everything to make sure, mm-hmm. you know, that their child stands out and, you know, is the center of attention. It's like those little children, you know, they grow up and they end up becoming those adults who have to have all the awards and have to have all the attention. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll go out of their way to sabotage others to make sure they don't have it. Mm-hmm. And they're only satisfied as long as a camera is on them or a microphone is in their face. Mm-hmm. You know, when that camera is on them or when that microphone is in their face, they say the nicest, kindest things about everybody mm-hmm. and, you know, sing kumbaya and, you know, talk about inclusion and diversity. And the reality of it is, they're full of shit.
Mm-hmm. They ain't too worried about it.
Not at all. I mean, we can't have you coming up in here taking all of this from us and you being in the center of attention. We not celebrate you. Oh, security. Out of here. Removed from the building. Houston, we have a problem. No, it's for me, I just look at it like that. You know, there's not enough attention to go around. You start getting attention and you start getting all these awards mm-hmm. and these accolades and all of this prestige, then what happens to us? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, are we supposed to wither away and die and go under a rock or a cave? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We haven't been under a rock or a cave, so we don't want to go under one now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to look at it any other kind of way other than the benefits that they are reaping are tremendous. They don't want to share the benefits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it serves them no purpose to share the benefits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It goes back to just, there's just, it's a very greedy, selfish world that we live in.
Well, also, like you were saying with the presentation of wanting to be inclusive and all that stuff, because I get a bit pissy, so to speak, in terms of people getting credit for tweeting. You know what I mean?
Getting recognition for tweets.
Yeah. Yes. And people do. They said, oh, well, you know, so-and-so yes. has been so... Mm-hmm. You know, they've done so much advocacy because, you know, they were tweeting about it before we were tweeting about it. And I said, you know, I was black before they were tweeting about it.
When did you know you were black?
Took a while.
It does take a while, right? Yeah.
You're like, oh, wow, I'm black. And that changes things.
Oh,
I'm colored.
Oh, okay.
That changes things.
I guess it's kind of like, what's her name? She was a female. And she was tweeting about some wild ride that she went on in Florida, and it had to do with sex. And yes, she was African American.
Yeah, and it was with a white girl.
Yeah, she was. She tweeted something like
Zola.
Tweeted. I remember because I posted something online about it. But she had tweeted her story, and supposedly they're turning into a script and some other things or whatever. So,
and that was totally fabricated.
So I guess tweeting works.
Yeah. For some people, that absolutely does. People have gotten book mm-hmm. deals from tweets. But, yeah. You know, it's funny because when you say the person who was winning all the awards and stuff in school mm-hmm. and how that, you know, hopefully you get out of that mindset real quick. I was thinking that was me in high school. I won all the awards. I didn't win every single one, but I won the majority of them.
I didn't win. I didn't win any because I couldn't compete. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, so I was to have no part of the world. I had no opinion. Couldn't be creative. So I was. I definitely. Mm. You know, I wasn't that child who. You know.
Yeah.
I didn't have a stage mom or whatever. But
yeah. My mom was a single mom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember I kept going up on stage, and some kids were like, damn, she's going up on stage a lot to get them awards. And, I mean, admittedly, some awards were because I was student council president. Some awards mm-hmm. were just like, oh, she's student council president. Give her that award because, okay. you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But
the politics behind it.
Exactly. I remember that some of them weren't earned, per se. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I talked to my best friend, still one of my best friends to this day, and I remember our teacher recommended my best friend for an award or a writing contest. And I have been winning all these things. And I said, well, hey, how come I didn't get it? And my best friend said, you get everything. I don't get anything. Can I have this? you know? Wow. And it was a reality check moment because it was, oh, snaps. I do. I mean, in this context, in this very specific context, I said, oh, wow. I have won a lot. Yeah, and you're right that you haven't been put up for things. And that's actually very fair. But, you know, at that moment, you're like, F you. I earned this. Right. I get everything. It's mine, yeah. And this is mine. I deserve this. I'm the writer. Blah, blah, blah.
It's interesting that you were saying, you know, earned and everything. Because from what I understand and from things that I read and things that I've seen, there are actually a lot of awards and fellowships and things that are out there for artists, but you can't apply for it. You have to be...
Oh, no, you have to be nominated. Like the Rona Jaffrey, which is $30,000, but you have to be nominated
for it. You have to be nominated for it, yeah.
And they're secret. It's, mm-hmm. They're like the Illuminati. You mm-hmm. have no idea who the judges
right.
are.
Right, yeah. It's so,
any
so there's,
given time.
There's stuff out there that...
I might have been a bitch to a judge for Rona Jaffrey and screwed my chances. And I don't even know it.
There, and I believe the American Fellowship, which is...
The MacArthur, too. I mean, the MacArthur is huge.
Oh, Lord.
MacArthur is the creme de la creme of... But yes. You have to be nominated for the MacArthur, too.
You have to be nominated for the MacArthur. You do, yeah. So you when you get that phone call, that's jackpot. That's solid gold. You did something right.
$650,000? Shoot.
And you never offended anybody along the way.
Or maybe you did, but, maybe... I don't know. It's so interesting, that kind of feelings of entitlement and how you can recognize that, because I'm happy my best friend said that to me. Like I said, we're still friends to this day, from high school to now in our mid-30s, and to be able to say, you get everything, and, you know, that can break friendships. We've seen privilege.
Yeah, right, but some of it, honestly, is well-deserved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It really is well, it can be very well-deserved, mm-hmm. and we never know why certain people, you know, receive that. We don't always know the stories behind the story.
Absolutely.
Because everything is not disclosed.
Absolutely.
And that's a part of business world, period. Businesses don't tell you everything. You know?
Which is why you have to Google it.
Yeah. Do some research. And I have all the time in the world, because that's all I do is research.
Getting all them grants. Many more to come.
I love to go digging for gold. If it's out there, I'll find it. Or I'll find out about it. You don't have to tell me. I'll find out about it. I love to read artist biographies.
So can we talk about Shooting Range? I'd love to talk about it.
Yes, we can talk about Shooting Range.
That won you a BRIO, which is the Bronx Council of the Arts, as well as the name of your memoir. Is that accurate? Tentative name?
Yes.
Okay. And it was adapted into a screenplay.
Which is still a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly being rewritten and, yeah.
We are always rewriting.
Right.
You see stuff in print, you're like, oh.
Had some creative issues with the producer that I was collaborating with at the time. So that collaboration had to come to an end.
Mm. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, it was for the best.
I hear you on that. I could tell you stories once we're off mic.
It was for the best. It got a little too real. A few words were exchanged that weren't too kind, and yeah. So.
Been there, and we'll be there again, I'm sure.
And you know, you want to remain professional.
Because you want that Rona Jaffrey nomination.
That MacArthur Award, that Emmy, that Tony, and those Lambda Awards as well.
And so Shooting Range is based on your own experiences of violence. And in terms of this story, I wanted to ask and get into, why did you want to tell it? And also ask your opinion in terms of, do you think these stories, particularly stories of kind of, what do we call it, the problem book, quote unquote, you know, where it's always, if the centerpiece is a gay person, if it's a gay male, lesbian, the book has to be about coming out. It has to be about the problems You know, so if it's with someone of specific race, it has to be about the problems of that race. If it's with someone featured who's disabled, it has to be about the problems. So we get these problem narratives that have, nowadays the term trauma porn is thrown around a lot, especially, and I had given you Orange is the New Black as the example with what happens. I won't say it in case people seen it, and I don't want to spoil it for people.
I don't even watch TV. I don't have cable.
You're not missing much.
Oh no, I know I'm not.
You're not missing much at all.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones though is pretty cool, but
okay.
Other than that, I'm like, give or take it. When these problem stories are written outside of communities that affect them, they tend to be, it tends to be that trauma porn, and I wonder if that's more insightful for the larger audience, or do you think that the masses truly see beyond the trauma depicted for marginalized people in work produced by the media these days? I mean, do you feel like because we have so many of these like gangbang or black kids or these immigrant Latino kids or these model minority Asian kids or, you know, prostitute, you know, transgender characters, that people see beyond that at all in terms of these stories?
My mother, to go back to shooting range, mm-hmm. start with that. My mother, she's dyslexic, so she made sure I learned how to read and write properly. And when I was younger, I was tasked with helping her read and write, which always confused me. I also grew up reading Bible stories weekly and believe that's where my love of storytelling developed. Storytelling comes naturally for me, especially after being around so many talented professionals. During 1998, I was employed by an actor, playwright, publisher, novelist, filmmaker, narcissist, and a closet lush. They used to always tell me, "Don't be surprised if you end up in one of my novels or plays." And it never dawned on them that I would become a writer and perhaps chronicle their character. Mm. A few years ago, I realized I had personal experiences to draw upon for creative purposes. Not many people have lived to tell and write narratives of how they were beat, handcuffed, and had a loaded 380 shoved into their mouth. And even though the events I endured transpired during 1997, I'm still in disbelief that I managed to injure my attacker with his own gun and walk away. As a survivor of a violent crime that could have led to my demise, I sustain immense delight, am obsessed and passionate in sharing my narrative with others, and receive an ethereal satisfaction that is indescribable. If I had to compare with anything, I would actually almost say that it's almost orgasmic, if that's appropriate.
That's cool.
Narrating the events that are seared into my memory allows me to continuously work through the trauma I endured, and I'm also extremely proud to be partially responsible for the arrest and conviction of a child rapist who is not eligible for parole until 2036. Mm. However, after sharing my tale thousands of times, I became bored with verbally rehashing it, and I figured I needed a new medium. So I challenged myself and attempted to learn the craft of writing to introduce my tale to a new audience and the literati. Besides, I've lived and seen more than most will ever see, even if they became a centurion. I've been through it all. I feel like I'm that rose that grew from concrete, and I'm my own hero. Mm. And I wanted to make sure that my story was told, and who better to tell it than me?
Absolutely.
And regarding the trauma porn, and I would agree that when certain narratives are told outside of the communities where they originated from, they then can be misconstrued and turned into trauma porn to fill that unquenching thirst that people have to see others suffer, as well as guarantees the producers or publishers an audience, which further adds to the dehumanization of marginalized people mm-hmm. when the stories are not told in a humane way versus entertainment and for profit only. I don't think the masses see beyond the trauma, and that's why it's so easy for people to go out in society and commit violent acts, because they've been too desensitized to the real long-lasting harmful effects that it causes. And I don't think they understand. I think it gets to a point where there's actually a disconnect with all of the violent entertainment that we have, and then a lot of it is misogynistic, is sexist, racist. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It's everything under the sun. So it makes it easier for them to treat you like an object versus a human being with mm-hmm. actual feelings. Because you see this on television. You see all this violence and this dehumanization on television. So then in real life,
just makes it easier for them to act it out in real life. And they see it on television, and then they want to act those things out in real life.
I also wonder if it's, we'll go back to Orange is the New Black, and I won't do a spoiler, but there's some messed up stuff that happens. And it's a lot of, one of the clear storylines that gets established, and that's not a spoiler, is that the white guards target the POC community in the jail, in the prison. I wonder if people look at that and they see someone doing something so egregious, mm-hmm. so repulsive, mm-hmm. that if they do something that's a microaggression, quote unquote, by comparison, or is not as bad as raping someone, but you're assaulting them in some way, or touching them in an inappropriate way, but it's like, well, I didn't rape, you know. I wonder if we quantify violence in a way that is not healthy, because it's mm-hmm. so bad mm-hmm. on TV, that what people do in real life is horrible. I mean, last week was a horrible week with the shootings unnecessarily and those lost lives. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if people look at it and think, also, well, it's not as bad as that. Mm. So what I'm doing isn't as bad as what that cop did. It's mm-hmm. not as bad as what that parole officer did on that show. It's not as bad as what she said. These standards that we have, I constantly feel as though, and I said this to my boss
like
too,
that,
I said
like
that we're getting
like
lowered.
As if there's levels of it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like violence doesn't have levels. Violence
oh, no, it
is
does
violence.
Not. Violence is violence. And for me, with shooting range, what I went through, and to make it out was so unbelievable to me that it's my story, but I still can't believe that happened to me, and I can't believe that I lived through it. And I know some would say, you know, why do you want to exploit it, or why do you want to talk about your trauma and your pain, or...
Is it exploiting it, though?
Because it's not exploiting it at all. No, it's the farthest thing from it. I don't feel like I'm reliving it over and over and again when I'm telling it or whatever. The images and the thoughts and the feelings will always be with me. And it's not my way of holding on to it. And, you know, for me, it's just something so unbelievable. And I think that's why I share it so much, because I'm like, I can't believe, I guess for some people, it would be like if they saw somebody with three heads, which we don't, some people are born with two heads.
Yeah.
Or I guess if somebody's something so abnormal or I don't even want to say freakish of nature, but something so abnormal that happens to a person. Out of the human experience, you can't help but keep talking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah, you see things on television and stuff, and that's TV, and that's supposed to be not real and stuff. Mm-hmm. Even a lot of that stuff is based on real life events. Mm-hmm. But then when something happens to you in real life, I have stories on my own, and not just based on shooting range, other things that I've seen, heard, or whatever. What happens in real life is much, much more fascinating to me versus what's on television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Versus especially made up stuff. And I mean, I don't dislike fiction, but I'm not a fan of fiction. I need nonfiction. I need give me something real. Real life gets me.
What about poetry?
I like poetry. I wish I could, you know, write poetry, but I can't, and I've never really tried. I mean, it's sure, at some point I will, but...
Because it's kind of a brand of fiction and nonfiction.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, Tupac was considered a poet, and mm-hmm. I was a fan of his, and, yeah, got to meet him at my high school prom. He took...
What?
No kidding, Tupac took one of my classmates, her name was Tashana Howard, he took her to our high school prom. We all thought that it was his goddaughter. Now that I'm understanding it wasn't his goddaughter, I believe she was a fan who, if I read correctly, she had wrote into him and got in touch with his people or whatever, some kind of way. And next thing you know, he was knocking at her door, taking her to her prom. Yeah, and we were able to take pictures with him that night. And I had told him I wanted to work in the entertainment industry and everything. And at that time, there was a production company that was producing his music videos, Look Here Productions. And he told me about Look Here Productions. That summer, I interned at Look Here Productions with Tracy Robinson and Gobi Naji. I'm probably butchering his name, but and I remember I didn't get a picture with him, but I was able to take a picture of him.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have it anymore to this day. But I only start talking about that because you brought up poetry, and he would be considered an urban poet.
Absolutely,
he's an urban poet. Yeah. Uh-huh. I have so much history in Southern California and Los Angeles, and even in the entertainment industry. I got to the point where I was like, I can't continue working and just, I was like, I have to write now. Mm-hmm. I have to write about the things that I've seen and things that I've experienced that mm-hmm. are definitely unique to me that I want to share with others mm-hmm. and that I know I can draw from and use for creative purposes. With me chronicling, writing Shooting Range, mm-hmm. that was the first thing I ever wrote, and then I won an award for it, and I already knew the scene that took place in my car that transpired that night, July 4th, 1997. I knew that would just make for, as horrific as it was, I knew it would still make for a great short film, mm-hmm. be based for a short film. And hopefully that's going to be the base, that's going to be used for my first short film that I'll make when I get the funding for that, which is another story. But I think the reason why I am having success to this degree is because I have an entertainment industry background. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say I necessarily know it works, but I've worked around so many people and mm-hmm. I've been in that environment. So it's not, I have a good feel.
So do you feel like when you write or when you see things as you're writing, it's very visual?
I see. Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very, very visual. It is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how much of a visual person I was. You know, I identify as transgender. I would be I'm a biological male. For several years, I took hormones. I didn't think I'd bring this up. Some people will say that, it's all psychological. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that had I not taken hormones for 5 years, off and on, the estrogen, I don't believe that I would have maybe became, I don't want to say necessarily became a writer, but I don't think I would have been able to express myself in the way I've been able to express myself with my writing projects. Although I was always around artists, I feel as if I was stifled. Even though I was being nurtured mm-hmm. by other artists and I was around them, it's like as if I was stifling myself. Mm-hmm. I feel like once I started taking those hormones, I became much more emotional I saw things much more differently mm-hmm. through the lens that I had saw them through previously mm-hmm. when I didn't have the female hormones in me. Mm-hmm. I became much more in tune with my thoughts, my feelings, extremely emotional and, which I feel has worked to my advantage because it's made me a much, much, much more expressive person. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
And I don't, I give some of the credit. I know it sounds crazy or whatever, but I give some of the credit. I give some of the credit to my experience with taking female hormones for 5 years, mm. helping me unblock my creativity. Mm. I mean, it is a drug and artists do all kinds. And I know it sounds like the craziest thing, but I really don't have anything else to attribute this to how I'm able to do this. I don't have anyone coming up with these stories or giving me these ideas. Mm-hmm. This is all it's generating from me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The story I'm using is 20 years old. But I mean, I'm not questioning it, it's working, but I do attribute the little bit of success that I'm having to my experience with having taken those hormones for 5 years. It did change my psychology.
Wow, so interesting. Mm-hmm. What's next?
I'm currently working on my memoir, and I have a editor who is, she's got her whip out, and she's slave driver, master, madame.
No, we can say that because we're black.
No, she's. I asked for her and I got her, and I'm so thankful that this individual is in my life and guiding me and is editing mm-hmm. me, and I'm thankful that they genuinely care about me mm-hmm. and are interested in my. Not success in the business world or mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm. just my success as a human being and cares about my well-being. I am legally disabled. I have post-traumatic stress disorder from my assault from 20 years ago. And along my journey, I met someone who I met a friend. I can honestly say I met a friend and met someone that cares about me, and I'm currently working on my memoir and going back and forth through that process. So that should be complete in a few months.
Oh, wow.
Very excited about that. And obtained a grant from the National Arts and Disability Center to hire an editor. Received that grant some time ago. And for me, again, it's kind of hard for me to, 20 years is a long time,
mm-hmm.
but your stories never get old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you can say what your teacher did to you or your friend in school. You were saying how you almost lost a friendship. That can still feel like it happened yesterday,
mm-hmm.
even though time went by.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I'm happy that I live this long. I'm happy that I lived this long and that I was able to get to this point
mm-hmm.
to share some of my narrative and to be able to do
mm-hmm.
what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy that I gave myself the opportunity and the how do you say it? Not the approval, but I'm happy that I allowed myself to do it
mm-hmm.
and to share it with others.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of satisfaction and I guess I just never. All this time, I never saw myself as an artist in that sense. And I'm sitting up around writers and directors and dancers and all these, always getting my makeup done and, you know, having photographs taken, stuff. And people would always say, you know, are you a dancer? You know, are you a singer? When people would look at me, that's the first thing they would think. Oh, you must be a dancer. You must be a singer. And I'd be like, no, I work in, you know, TV and film production, or I've done some acting, or you know, I've done some modeling, and I'm an actor, Screen Actors Guild, da da da. But people always assumed, oh, you must be a dancer, or even a makeup artist or hairstylist myself. And I was like, no, and it doesn't surprise me. I guess my thing is, I'm like, Nishan, how did you? What took you so long to get to this point? Like I was supposed to be a writer decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what took you so long to get here?
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I totally feel. And now that I'm here, and for all of this to be happening like this, I'm just like, it's the weirdest thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to really describe
yeah,
it.
Makes
Even
sense.
Though I'm responsible for all of it, I'm just like. it's a little I went to the
shocked face.
I went to the literary awards, and Toni Morrison was given an award, and so was Ta-Nehisi Coates. Neither one of them were there. Ta-Nehisi's father accepted on his behalf, and
oh, yeah.
I forgot who accepted on Mrs. Morrison's behalf. And then I went to the Lambda Literary Awards, and just being at these award ceremonies and stuff with these, you know, these
my
literati
gosh.
And these Hilton Owls, and I'm like, I mean, just a few years ago, I was standing around outside till sunrise and couldn't sleep and doing things and
mm-hmm.
handcuffs and getting arrested by the cops and stuff. And my life, that's what I said, I had quite a roller coaster with having post-traumatic stress disorder. It affects your moods and your emotions, and it is debilitating for some people. Depending on how you're able to cope,
mm-hmm.
but I got to New York, and I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because I came here when I was in my 20s,
mm-hmm.
and lived here for 6 months, and hurried up and ran back home, tucked my tail between my legs and ran back home, because I was like, oh no, they're just. Oh, I was like, no. And I was in my 20s, and I couldn't cope. It was mm-hmm. just too much. But I always knew I wanted to be here in New York. And I knew that this was the place for me to explore writing. I just knew that. I couldn't do it in Los Angeles. And I didn't do it in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I was only able to write once I got here. And it came out. And it is still coming out. And I was, thankfully, the individual who assaulted me when I was 19, that July of 1997, cooperated with me and gave me an apology as to why he assaulted me. He gave me an apology and took responsibility for the gun being his. So it really helped and is helping me that he has, what is the word called? He has...
come to terms with his role in it?
No, he has cooperated with me and given me the information and things about his background that have been able to help me paint a picture of him to a degree and to understand who I was dealing with, because that night we had just met briefly, so I didn't have too much of a clue as to who he was. So he filled me in about his background, who he was, and you know what kind of, I see what kind of person he is. So I think had I not had his cooperation, I don't think I would be having the success that I'm having to this point. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
And then it's interesting, you know, start talking about research and everything. And I just start digging around because I'm basically writing a memoir that deals with crime. Mm-hmm. And I had reached out to the district attorney's office and I was given information about the case that I didn't know existed. And I found out details about the case that I don't want to say it now or whatever, because it'll be in the memoir or whatever. But I was just so shocked. I was like, "That's what he said." It was pretty unbelievable. He was found in a park with a gunshot in his leg, after I fled the scene from when we had our tussle in my car, and the police officers found him there, and that's where he was arrested at, and then we were taken to the hospital together. But it was really shocking when, I won't give it away now because it'll be given away, but it was rather, to me, it was, I could have choked when I read the police report and who he said had attacked him. It I'm laughing because it's not funny. it wasn't anybody that looked like me. Mm. So yeah, he was quite a storyteller. He is a storyteller himself. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was just a story. It's something I couldn't take to the grave. Mm-hmm. I have had to share this with people. Mm-hmm. Really, like, had to share it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for it. No pressure.
So how can people contact you?
I can be reached at my handle is ShootingRange97, mm-hmm. or you can just look for the. Google Nashon, NASHON Anderson.
Yeah, Twitter. You'll see all the accolades. Stop. It is many. True. The first thing that comes up, I believe, is the Lambda Lit thing.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, okay. And the Google search.
Okay.
Yes. When you Google the verb, Google.
Google is a verb.
And a noun.
Google, yes.
So thanks so much for tuning in to the latest episode. Once again, you can find it at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. Thanks again, Nashon.
Thank you for having me.